It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we look at how the Affordable Care Act is affecting HIV-positive people here in Wisconsin.
But first, two groups of scientists reported yesterday that a large part of the ice sheet that covers the West Antarctic is rapidly melting due to global warming.
These reports have jolted the scientific community, who fear that this could lead to a significant rise in sea levels sooner than previously expected.
A scientist on one of the teams is with us now to share the findings. Eric Rignot is professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine, and a glaciologist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, Eric, you're part of one of the teams that discovered this rapid melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet. What did you find?
Well, maybe the word discovered is a little bit too strong. We've known about the evolution of ice in this sector of Antarctica for quite a while. Probably the last 20 years, we've been keeping a close eye to this part of Antarctica. It's more like we reached the point where we collected enough observations and multiple lines of evidence, and especially along the lines of mapping the bed beneath the ice sheets, to reach our conclusion that the retreat of ice in that sector was unstoppable.
As I understand it, this is an ice sheet that is sort of in the form of a bowl and that there is water underneath it that's contributing to the retreat of the ice. Is that how you describe it?
It's in the form of the bowl because the ice depresses the crust beneath it. So as you move farther inland, the ice getting thicker and the bed is at lower elevation. The base of the glaciers are all below sea level, so that big piece of ice wants to become afloat into the ocean. But there's no water underneath that ice sheet. It's just at the periphery. Right? These glaciers flow into the ocean, and they develop these floating extensions that interact vigorously with the ocean.
And so how did these two teams, your team included, come to the conclusion that what is happening now with this ice sheet in Antarctica is unstoppable, that it will be retreating and it's going to lead to rising sea levels?
The reason we reached that is that we have long-term observations of the evolution of the glacier velocity, all the glaciers in this area. We've seen all the glaciers in that sector respawn, accelerate, thin, and retreat at the same time, which suggests the common cause for the forcing, which is the ocean. We've seen the retreat of the grounding line, the place where they meet with the ocean and become afloat. And one of the important pieces also is that we gathered a lot of information on the topography of the bed beneath the ice sheet. This was done over many years of surveys by aircraft, combined with some other data to reveal high-resolution details to sort of unravel if there were any pieces of the bed topography that could slow down the retreat of these glaciers towards the interior. And we reached the point where we think that there's no such thing, no such big mountain that could halt their retreat.
Now, scientists, as a general rule, don't tend to be hysterical about things. They don't tend to be overly dramatic or use hyperbole. And yet, a lot of the quotes that I've seen about this, it's clear that this has sort of shaken those in the community who study glaciers. How big a deal is this?
I think among the community of glaciologists, it's probably not a big surprise to make this statement. You know, the concept of the instability of this part of Antarctica was brought forward by brilliant scientists back in the 70s, Terry Hughes and Bob Thomas and others. At the time, there was no observations to confirm whether these projections were right or not. We had to wait until the 1990s to really get some good observations of this part of Antarctica. It's one of the most remote parts of Antarctica.
And as I understand it, some of those who put forth the theory that this part of the glacier was vulnerable back in the 80s, those scientists were sort of harassed and not listened to, and yet here it has come to pass. What do you think happened over that scope of time to get us to this point where it seems as though that prediction is correct?
Well, I think not necessarily harassed, but there was a little bit of suspicion that, well, maybe they were right, maybe not. And since there was no direct observations of these areas, it was very difficult to go one way or another. This really changed around the early 1990s, where we could actually observe the evolution of these glaciers from satellites for the first time. Also, some research teams ventured for the first time by ship in these areas to unravel what the ocean temperature were looking like along the coastline.
And what will be the impact of this?
Well, the impact over the long term, because as we mentioned in our reports, this is the long term retreat of ice in West Antarctica. It's going to take a couple of centuries for all the ice to be removed from these areas. The long term impact, of course, is sea level rise. There's enough ice to raise global sea level by a meter, four feet in this sector. But it will most likely entrain the retreat of the rest of West Antarctica, which could contribute another 10 feet of sea level rise.
And we're talking about melting that will occur over centuries, right?
It's difficult. That's a tough question. The timescales of evolution of these entities. We are at the point where we can say with reasonable certainty that this ice is going to go into the ocean. Whether it's going to take one or two centuries or three or four centuries, the jury is still a little bit out on that. The numerical models, the computer models that require to be used to do this are making progress. They're getting better at it, but they're not at the point where we can really rely on them for projection into the future.
Would you expect to see rising ocean levels that would affect coastal communities, for example, in the shorter term, maybe within our lifetimes?
Well, I think the projections for the end of this century are of a global sea level rise of about a meter. It could be a little bit more than that, a little bit less. This is not necessarily the type of number that you will see emerge from IPCC reports that form a consensus opinion based on all published literature of many years back, and also that uses numerical models that cannot quite account for all the rapid changes that are taking place in the Antarctic at present. So they inherently underestimate the contribution of these entities to sea level. 1 meter is a big deal. It will affect a large number of the coastal population around the world, millions of people. And in some places, they will be able to adapt. In some others, they will not, and they will have to move away. But the world does not end in 2100 either, and sea level rise will continue well beyond that.
Now, as I understand it, the New York Times reported that the ozone hole over Antarctica may also have been something that has played a role in this.
Yes.
How would that factor in here?
Well, a lot of the changes we're seeing in the Antarctic, they are a little bit more difficult to explain to the public than what's happening in Greenland, where you have warmer air temperature, warmer ocean, and everything melts. Nothing is melting in the Antarctic, at least not yet. Or wherever it melts, the meltwater stays in place. The changes we're seeing are associated with changes in oceanic circulation in the Antarctic, which are associated with the wind pattern. The wind regime around the Antarctic continent. And that wind regime is pretty much driven by the temperature distribution around the Earth. And in the last few decades, the rest of the world has been warming up faster than Antarctica. And the ozone has played a role in that, in keeping Antarctica cool. And the greater temperature differential between Antarctica and the rest of the world has increased the wind speed around Antarctica and allowed some of these subsurface warm water to intrude in places where they didn't used to be as much.
According to some reports, NASA called an urgent meeting on this yesterday, and you're a senior research scientist at NASA. How worried are you and your colleagues about this?
Well, it's not. This story is not really about worrying people. It's about making a stand that we reached a point in our understanding and observation of this part of Antarctica that we can say that the ice in this sector is going to retreat and continue retreat almost no matter what. Now, of course, the models clearly suggest that in a context of of a warmer climate, if climate continues to warm, it is likely that the retreat of ice in that sector will proceed on a much faster pace.
Eric, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That was Eric Regnault, professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine, and glaciologist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab.
The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act requires that all Americans enroll in health insurance. Now, while coverage for all may be new and contentious for the country at large, the necessity of health care isn't new for many Wisconsinites with conditions that require ongoing care.
That's the case for Wisconsinites living with HIV and AIDS. HIV care requires ongoing attention from medical professionals and long-term use of antiretroviral therapy, and that need to spawn organizations around the globe that provide care to those who need it, insured or not.
One of those organizations is the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin. Here to share with us how their work is changing in light of the Affordable Care Act, we have the president of the center, Michael Gifford. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And then we've got Caitlin Stahlnacher. She's Affordable Care Act specialist with the center. Caitlin, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Well, some of the people in higher risk groups for contracting HIV also in the past may have been people not likely to have health insurance or a stable home environment, sex workers, intravenous drug users. Since the AIDS crisis began, caring for those vulnerable populations has been a challenge. Now we're all required to have health insurance. Mike, let's start with you. How is that changing the work you do?
You know, the Affordable Care Act provides such great opportunity for the fight against HIV and AIDS. And at the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin, we're very proud of the fact that we've helped about 750 of our patients and clients enroll in health care over the course of the last 6 months or so. And what that means is really a ticket to access to care that they need for that long and healthy life, whether it's the health care we provide as the largest provider of HIV medical care in the state of Wisconsin or specialty care that they may need to access elsewhere.
And Caitlin, are there provisions in the Affordable Care Act specifically to help people with HIV?
Certainly. They've done away with extended wait periods for people with pre-existing conditions, and they've also done away with lifetime caps on claims.
And Mike, with the medications people with HIV take, they take them for over the long term. How has that changed, if at all?
Well, the good news on the medication front, if we were to rewind 20 years when antiretroviral therapy first came out, it would be a handful of medications every day. And for many people with HIV and AIDS today, their HIV can be well treated with simply one pill one time a day. It's very costly. It remains at least $2,000 a month for that regimen. And that's where the Affordable Care Act can come in to help cover that incredibly high cost and free up resources for other needs that low-income people with HIV would have.
Caitlin, I know a big focus of parts of the Affordable Care Act was on preventative medicine. Are there things out there as part of the Affordable Care Act targeted at HIV prevention?
It's really just prevented, preventing healthcare symptoms coming up. There's really nothing directly related to HIV, but preventative services like yearly checkups, labs that HIV patients are required to have very regularly, all of that is covered under the Affordable Care Act.
Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I think that's one of the disappointments in the Affordable Care Act. Here in Wisconsin, we continue to see several hundred new HIV infections on an annual basis. We haven't seen new resources come forward to help reduce those numbers of new HIV infections in well over a decade. And that's where state and federal policy really needs to focus on if we're ever to bring about an end to the AIDS epidemic.
And for people with HIV, I know other secondary infections are often a big part of the problem. Is that the preventive care or the care provided under the Affordable Care Act, is that do you think going to help prevent those secondary infections?
Absolutely. It's secondary infections, and it's also comorbid conditions. So people with HIV and AIDS are much more likely to struggle with issues like diabetes, neurocognitive impairment, different cancers. And we're seeing that among people with HIV maybe a generation earlier than what we would see among people with healthy immune systems. So people with in their late 40s or early 50s who are starting to address memory or have memory loss issues. And that's why the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin and our unique HIV medical home model of care is so important. All that care is provided in one location, removing many of the social barriers to successful care and treatment.
And Mike, what are the biggest controversies here in Wisconsin related to the Affordable Care Act surrounds Medicaid expansion, which the state has rejected? Does that have an impact on the work you do?
Well, certainly for anybody who post-ACA startup doesn't have health care coverage, that certainly is a barrier. We're happy that with the changes to the state Medicaid program that we were able to enroll about 400 new HIV patients into that care and treatment. And then the other important aspect here is that the state has used the Affordable Care Act in a little-known section of it, 2703, to help create a new benefit for Medicaid recipients. It's an HIV medical home benefit that provides enhanced funding for care and treatment and care coordination that will help achieve better outcomes. So we're pleased with that.
Caitlin, do you have advice for Wisconsinites with HIV or someone maybe close to them who don't currently have health insurance? They're signing up for it, or maybe they've just signed up for it. What kind of advice do you offer them?
The first thing I say is seek out community resources. ARCW is a great organization that offers many comprehensive services that address housing. There's food pantry services, transportation for people that might not be able to get to their medical appointments. Really just search out the community resources that are available to them.
And Mike, moving beyond the Affordable Care Act for a bit, I want to get a sense of the state of the art, the scope of HIV in Wisconsin, about how many people are affected by it now.
We estimate that there's about 7,000 people living with HIV in the state of Wisconsin, and that makes Wisconsin one of the low-incident states, and we're appreciative of the opportunity we've had to help contribute to that through aggressive HIV prevention for the gay community and certainly through injection drug users. But then I think we also have to acknowledge that care and treatment for people living with HIV and AIDS is critical to containing the epidemic, not only to the individual, where we can work with them to achieve a clinical outcome called an undetectable viral load. That means you're still HIV positive, but your HIV is managed as well as possible. That's good for them, but it's also good for the communities, because some studies show that people with an undetectable viral load are as much as 96% less likely to be able to transmit the disease. So treatment has become a part of the prevention focus here in Wisconsin and around the country.
And what, for you, is the biggest grounds for improvement on how we're dealing with HIV in the state?
Well, I think the nationally unique model of care that I mentioned earlier, the HIV medical home that was created under the Affordable Care Act, that integrated model of care where we have a group of professionals like social workers like Caitlin, physicians, dentists, pharmacists, mental health staff, all working together to meet the needs of HIV patients. It is very unique. It's something that I'm really proud that ARCW has been leading the country on. And we've been able to achieve a clinical outcome where 83% of our patients have an undetectable viral load. That's that magic spot where that's the best clinical outcome possible for our patients. And what's happening is that there are now organizations in 23 different states around the country that are reaching out to ARCW to learn about our model of care and how they can implement it in their states.
And Caitlin, Mike just mentioned that you're a social worker, you're working on these issues. Do you see improvement over time? Are you feeling more and more optimistic about the future of people with HIV in the state?
Certainly. I mean, the integrated care model that Mike's been talking about really helps clients address the barriers that they might have to making themselves healthy and keeping them healthy. I really think that the stigma that comes along with an HIV diagnosis is also being addressed in the state of Wisconsin. So I certainly think it's improving.
I wanted to follow up on that stigma issue with you, Mike. We've been watching this, 30 plus years now. It seems like public attitudes toward HIV have really changed a lot in those decades.
You know, we have seen great progress. And in my 22 years leading ARCW, I certainly have experienced a much greater public acceptance of this disease. But then, you know, we have things like what Mr. Sterling, the owner of the Clippers, said recently, you know, that Magic Johnson should be ashamed that he's HIV positive. And unfortunately, at ARCW, one of our services that we offer is legal representation for people with HIV. And every year, there's two or three or four cases of substantial discrimination. People with HIV who are fired from their jobs because their HIV status, not provided the health care they need because they're HIV positive, kicked out of their homes because they're HIV positive. So while I agree, Caitlin, with Caitlin's comments that it's getting better, there still is a deeply rooted, smaller part of stigma for people with HIV.
We'll leave it there. Mike, thank you so much for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you very much.
And Caitlin, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Caitlin Stalnaker and Mike Gifford. They're both with the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin.
We've talked on the show in the past about making and crafting things, mainly how-tos and do-it-yourself projects you can do at home. But when was the last time you really thought about why you were making something and what you were getting out of it?
Our next guest is a longtime furniture maker who says the challenging work of bringing something new and meaningful into the world through one's own creativity, whether we're talking about arts or in the kitchen or the marketplace, it's exactly what generates the meaning and fulfillment we're looking for in life. In a new book, he lays out his thoughts about what exactly it means to make something.
Joining us now is Peter Korn. He's the founder and executive director of the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship. His new book is called Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, The Education of a Craftsman. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Veronica, a pleasure to be here.
Well, you've spent more than 40 years in the world of carpentry, taking an idea from a concept to the process where you make it with your own hands and the final product. After all that time, what is it you find magical about working with your hands and building something, making something?
Actually, several things. Maybe the most important one is this experience that one can have, or that I have, of coming up with an idea and then doing what's always the really demanding work of bringing it into the world in a way that matters. It's always a miracle, that you should think of something and then there it should be in front of you. And in the case of furniture, there it should be in front of you, useful and maybe even beautiful. That's wonderful.
A lot of us today, we work in offices, we work in front of computers, and we forget to blink more than once a minute. And you're doing sort of the opposite. I mean, you're thoughtfully working with your hands and conceiving things and making them. What do you think that those of us who don't actually get in there and work with our hands are missing out on?
Well, first, I just to be completely honest about who I am and what I do, I was a furniture maker full-time for many years, but I've gone on to do a lot of teaching at the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship and other places. And also, I have a great passion now for writing. So I'm involved in a number of different things and don't feel really comfortable just saying to the world that I'm a furniture maker. That's not how I'm
sure.
living anymore. But I am passionate about craft and what there's something about working with real materials in the real world that's very different, for example, than the experience I have working at a computer screen in the school office all day. And part of that difference is you actually can see the results of what you do as you do it right in front of you in a way that's lasting and sort of nailed down, if you'll let me say it that way, which is certainly not the case when we're working virtually on things.
Well, one of the things you've been writing about, obviously, is some of the deeper philosophical questions about why we make things, including furniture and anything else people might care to make. And what is your answer to that question? What is the deeper underpinning of what comes of it?
The best way for me to at least begin to explain that is to talk about the personal epiphany that underlies the book, what happened that I'm exploring in the book. And it's this. I became a furniture maker, a carpenter in 1972, and after 2 years started making furniture. And for the first 6 years I was a furniture maker, I sold my work at craft shows. But around 1980, I started showing in art galleries, and that meant I had to write an artist statement. And so the way I best described what I was doing in 1980 in an artist statement was to write that I was trying to make furniture that had the qualities of simplicity and integrity and grace. Now, 10 years after that, I was the program director at an art center, and I was working on another artist statement in a workshop with a critic named Arlene Raven. And in the course of that writing that statement, I realized the reason I had become a furniture maker in the first place was that I had somehow imagined that by acquiring these skills and practicing them diligently, I would cultivate more of the qualities of integrity and simplicity and grace within myself. And that led me to see first that for me, really, I was a furniture maker because I imagined that somehow the process of being a craftsman would be transformational to me even more than it was to the wood that I was working with. And by extension, I strongly believed, and now I'm convinced, that really every person who engages in a self-expressive creative endeavor, whether professionally or amateur, their first reason for doing it isn't because the world needs another book or symphony or chair. It's because they expect somehow to learn more about who they are and who they can become and what the nature is of the world around us through the creative process.
And there was a moment there when you surprised your family, wasn't there? You seemed as though you were going to go on to college, maybe to a high-intensity career like your father before you, but you instead chose this other path. Can you tell us what happened at that moment?
Yeah, well, I actually had the good fortune to go to a Quaker high school in Philadelphia called Germantown Friends, and then from there to the University of Pennsylvania, where I majored in history. And after college, I one thing I was sure of is that real life was somewhere else besides in school, and I wanted to try to find it. And I moved to a then quiet place called Nantucket Island in 1972. And the first job that came along was someone offered me a job as a carpenter. And that, in my parents' world, I had never met anyone who worked with their hands. My father was a lawyer and my mother was an historian. And I was under the presumption, and let's put it this way. When I told my dad I was becoming a carpenter and taking a job, he was not a happy man. He felt that it would leave me intellectually underwhelmed as a life, and he was so wrong. And actually, my dad's now 90 years old, and he happily tells me he was wrong, which was great.
Well, let's talk about it, actually. That's really interesting that your dad thought you were going to be intellectually underwhelmed, and instead you found just the opposite, following this path. What is it that you found that engages your intellect and sort of, you know, your whole being as you do it?
Well, starting with carpentry, as a carpenter, you're not only engaging, physical skills, but you're always thinking. There's so much cognitive problem solving involved in figuring out how you're going to go about something, what's the most efficient way, problems that come up. That itself engages your mind quite a bit. But then when I started 2 years later to make furniture, I also started designing the things I was making. And once you start designing, every part of you is engaged, your head, your heart, and your hand in what you're doing. And that, I guess, is another, you asked me earlier what makes craft so fulfilling. It's the fact that every capacity you have is working together in unison to create what you're doing.
Do you think that people who are engaging in making things and craft like you are, do you think they're accorded the respect that they deserve in our society?
No, but then so many people aren't accorded the respect they deserve in our society, starting with school teachers. We value funny things, and I've been speaking about this book all over the country, I'm always interested in the question and answer sessions that happen afterwards, and one thing that comes up just so clear over and over from these discussions is if you are someone who has a creative passion, our society does not provide you with any useful yardsticks for valuing and understanding and explaining to others what you do. Because really, the yardsticks that society gives us are we value things in terms of money and fame. And if you look at the pinnacle of the art world and read about what happens there, what do they ever discuss except for money and fame? And so that's an example. And yet, if you have a creative passion, you know that there are psychological and spiritual and emotional rewards that go way beyond anything measurable in terms of money and fame. But if you're in a career where the rewards are not about money and fame. The society at large has very little way to understand what you're doing or value it.
So as a teacher and a writer now, how do you go about encouraging people who see what you do, who get your message, and who want to engage in creative stuff? What do you do to encourage them?
Just keep yapping. This is what I'm doing. That's about it. I mean, is that, and we run a school in Maine where we have about 400 students a year. And because of my own outlook, the premise of our education is that even when someone's learning the most basic woodworking skills, they're still designing the project they're going to work on so that they can start to bring that creative part of themselves into play. And what I say to people who are interested and somehow prevented from trying something creative is, you just go do it, and you make mistakes, and you screw up, and that's how you learn, and that's what it's like.
Well, we're talking right now with craftsman Peter Korn about the value of crafting and making things with our own two hands. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a crafter or a maker? And what about it brings fulfillment to your life? Do you think there is a real hunger out there in the digital world to work with our hands instead of maybe something more abstract? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Peter Korn about why we make things and why it matters.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you make a living by doing some kind of crafting, or is that your hobby? What drew you to that? What do you love about building something from scratch? Call 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
And we're going to go to the phones right now. We've got Rhea joining us in Madison. Hi, Rhea.
Hi there. I'm actually graduating from a cabinet making program this Friday.
And I
never really thought it was possible for me to craft as a profession because I kind of got thrown into the university track. But I'm really excited to be finishing and just designed my own project and finished it. So I'm in complete agreement that, you know, it's the most fulfilling thing I could find to do. So I really appreciated the discussion about the values that we place on careers.
How did you end up making that transition from the college track to cabinetry and crafting?
I actually, it was a little bit of negative reinforcement. I was an executive assistant and found it very unfulfilling. I wanted to build things, and so I just decided to go and do that.
Okay, great. Well, congratulations on graduating this Friday. Peter, what comes to mind there?
Oh, I was going to ask Rhea to give a shout out to the name of her program. But
she's still there, Rhea?
The MAPC Cabinet Making Program. Thanks a lot, guys.
There we go. Yeah, and Peter, I read that there are really only three places in the country you can go if you want to learn furniture making.
If you want to learn really, really fine furniture making, there's certainly three top schools you would go to. The North Bennett Street School in Boston, the College of the Redwoods in California, and then the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship, our school in Maine. At least that's my opinion, of course. There may be a few other opinions on that.
And what about these smaller schools that teach things, you know, like Rhea's cabinetry?
Well, one thing is it is really hard to make a decent living with the dream that many of our students have, which is to be self-employed, work alone, and just design and build one exquisite piece of furniture after another. And a much more practical way to make a living as a woodworker is what Rhea's doing. If she's in the cabinet-making program, she's probably learning what we call architectural millwork, which is where you would make things that were needed by architects and interior designers. So it could be outfitting the inside of a new bar, for example, or replacement windows on a historic house. And it could be kitchen cabinets. And for those sorts of things, you can't outsource those out of the country. There's always going to be work for those things. So she's probably made some good choices.
Excellent. Well, good luck to Rhea. And let's go next to Ariel in Madison. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. What is your experience with crafting?
So I've been doing crocheting for a long time, you know, crocheting hats and different kinds of things like that. And then recently I learned how to do hand spinning, so to spin my own yarn from wool. And it's been a really, really interesting kind of connection between
taking it one step further and kind of learning how people used to, you know, crochet for a livelihood and how to make their own clothing. And it's been really fun learning how yarn is made and how it's, you know, comes from animals. And so adding that dimension to crafting, I think, has been really, really interesting.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for sharing that with us, Ariella. And Peter, she's working with her hands with yarn. It's another way to go.
Right. And one thing she reminded me of listening to her is I'm assuming she's considerably younger than I am. And for me, becoming a carpenter and then becoming a furniture maker was very much a process of creating my adult self, of finding a person to grow into. And so it was a process of self-discovery at the same time as it was a process of discovering the craft itself, step by step. And that's the feeling I got listening to Ariel about maybe what her experience was like at present.
Do you think that's true about any profession that really suits you, that you can grow into it? Or do you think there's something particular about crafting?
No, I think I'm assuming all young people do, or they're looking for a good way to grow into an adult self that they'll want to become. For me, craft, making things with my own hands and designing them, happened to be a great way to do it.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Ariel. And we go to Daniel in Minong. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. In the little RV that I live in, there's a German-made anvil. There are actually two anvils, hammers, and tools to do silversmithing. I create many different things. But the reason why we create objects is it's genetic. It's instinctive. It's in our genes.
All right.
I could not agree more with that.
Really interesting perspective. Peter, do you want to elaborate on that? It's in our genes. I mean, it's something humans are meant to do is make stuff.
This is something I find myself saying, because another thing I am hearing all over the country is people expressing something that you said at the beginning, which is, as our daily experience becomes more and more virtual, are we losing touch with some really essential part of ourselves? And the answer, I believe, is yes, and it does not bode well for the future of craft in the society. But on the other hand, human beings have been making things out of natural materials through millions of years of evolution to advance their survival. And that has to be so inbuilt in us. The pleasure we get in doing it, really, it's a kind of joy. And how fascinating and involving it is, how engaging it is. I'm pretty sure that, I agree with Daniel, that is biological and it's just embedded in us.
You know, there's a cartoonist, Linda Berry. She has a national profile, but she lives here in Wisconsin. And we've had her on the show, and she thinks there's something special about the hand, and that when we work with the hand, you know, she's a cartoonist. In your case, you know, you craft, you make things with hands, with your hands. She thinks that it's something that is therapeutic to the brain, and it keeps us mentally healthy. Do you buy that?
I do, and my significant other is an elementary school teacher, and she tells me that current research says that students actually remember more when a teacher is lecturing to them if they're free to doodle at the same time. I think being physically engaged with the hand is, well, again, it's central to what we are and how we evolve.
Let's go to another caller here. We've got Ike joining us from Reedstown. Hey, Ike.
Hi. I've been, thanks for taking my call. I've been a cabinet maker, carpenter for 30 years now. And the last company I worked for, we did architectural millwork. And which is very interesting because you never, all the jobs are different. You know, you don't make the same cabinet again. You don't make the same wall panel. You don't make the same molding. Everything's different. Like one, for instance, a lot of our work was in Las Vegas, but we did the Overture Center, which is quite complicated. And people don't realize how much you have to know to make moldings, to make cabinets. There's a lot that goes into it. And I think it's really underappreciated by people who have no idea what you do. And you try to tell them and they have no idea what you're talking about. And it's a shame because there's other countries like Germany or the Scandinavian countries who appreciate woodworkers and know, you know, they're well paid and respected, and it's not that way here. The pay is low, and
right, gotcha. Well, thank you, Ike, and thank you for sharing your experience. We were talking about that a little earlier, Peter, about whether, you know, people who work with their hands are given respect in society. Ike's saying not so much, but it doesn't have to be this way. And I wonder if you actually see maybe a resurgence of respect going back to it, sort of with the new maker movement that's going on right now.
I don't. I mean, I hate to be a pessimist, but I really don't. There's this intrinsic divide, it's called the Cartesian divide, in our society, where things associated with the mind have high status and things associated with the body tend to have low status, and carpentry and furniture making and craft are associated with the body. But there is, in that maker movement, that goes back to illustrating what I was saying a moment ago and also the previous caller, which is people just have such an inbuilt need to make things. And the maker movement is wonderful because it's tens or hundreds of thousands or millions of people who are just rediscovering various crafts for themselves. They're not going to school for it. They're not necessarily looking at what's been done in the past, but they're attracted to it and doing what they can with the materials at hand.
Peter, I want to ask you, listening to you, listening to Ike, and so many of the callers here, it's inspiring to hear so many people working with their hands and getting so much out of it. Is this, do you think, something that anybody can learn? I mean, obviously, there are different routes you can take in to get there, but what about people who just feel like they're not good with their hands?
Yes. Well, the answer is yes. It's something that anyone can do and learn. And running a school, I see that there's a wide variety of aptitudes for this, but there is no one who can't come in to a place like our school and not leave being better at making things than they were when they got there and good enough at it to pursue it in some fashion that's rewarding. So I think everyone has this capacity.
And Peter, in our last 30 seconds here, the rise in technology seems like it could have some pretty big implications for the future of craft. How do you see the role of technology in the world of craft?
Well, we have new tools that have come along in the last decade, specifically 3D printers and CNC routers, all computer actuated. And those are wonderful tools for a craftsperson to add to their existing skill. They let us do some things better. And the only danger is if we get so digitally oriented that we think those are the only means of fabrication. And then I've noticed that the quality of what people make tends to suffer.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Veronica.
We've been talking to Peter Korn, author of Why We Make Things and Why It Matters.